Hello and welcome to Newspeak. I'm Peter Whittle, and as usual, very, very pleased to be joined by Rafe Haderman-Koo, our senior fellow and historian or commentator, and Amy Gallagher, who is the STP candidate for the Mayoralty of London, as well as the woman behind Stand Up to Woke. However, before we start discussing the events of the week, just a few notes for you. First and foremost, our national conference, which is on Saturday, April the 20th, promises to be excellent. All your favourite people are going to be there and speaking. We also have David Starkey, Richard Tice, a number of other people. And the title of it this year is State of Emergency. I don't think you will disagree with that when it comes to talking about our country. Anyway, that's the 20th of April. And if you would like to come to that, there are still some tickets. So basically, go to the link under this video, or indeed just go to our website, newcultureforum.org.uk. 20th of April, it should be a great day. Also, we have some local events. You know, our locals are, you know, burgeoning all over the country, I'm pleased to say. And in April, we have a whole number of them coming up, but I'm just going to highlight three here, and I need my phone for this. So basically, first of all, in April, on the 9th of April, we have an event in Manchester. So if you're in Manchester, you might be interested to go to that one. And then on the 17th of April, we have events in Carlisle and Beaconsfield. So if you would like to go to either one of those, if you're in the areas, particular areas, then just please do go to locals@newcultureforum.org.uk. And we will happily give you the venues and the time. Obviously, these are in the evening, and they are free, and they are proving to be very popular. Okay. First things first, it wasn't that long ago, Amy, that we were all out on the street, or most of us were out on the street clapping the NHS, right?
Yeah.
This is where you've worked, obviously, for years as well. But apparently, according to a report this week, our confidence in it is at an all-time low, or a very low point.
Yeah, that's right. There's a recent survey that showed actually satisfaction rates within patients in the NHS is the lowest it's actually ever been. Less than a quarter of people report being satisfied with the NHS. I think they've been taking surveys for this for over 40 years, and it's the lowest it's ever been. I think, you know, people have cited the fact that they're waiting for GP appointments and they can't get GP appointments. That's one of the reasons they're dissatisfied. But also, we know 7.5 million people are on waiting lists for routine appointments. That's increased dramatically since the COVID years, where before pre-pandemic years, it was about 3 million people were waiting for routine appointments. So that's more than doubled. So I think there's just a general resentment about the fact that for 2 years we were told that the NHS is everything. You know, give up your freedom, give up your life to save the NHS. The NHS became a sort of national religion, and you could not criticise the NHS. You couldn't criticise doctors or nurses or the service in general.
Yeah.
And actually, we're now in a situation where most people are feeling absolutely let down by the NHS in all sorts of ways. We also know that cancer treatment, cancer survival rates have dipped significantly. We used to be one of the world leaders for cancer survival rates. And now actually, in terms of the Anglosphere, among the wealthy countries, we're lagging behind. We're behind Australia, behind Canada, we're behind Norway. And there's a huge backlog of people waiting for cancer treatment. So this is, I think the national religion of the NHS is, I think people are starting to feel tired of that now. I think even people that used to, you know, clap for the NHS, as it were, are feeling, you know, actually this system is not working anymore, is not doing what it's supposed to do. And there's a lot of unfairness as well in the NHS.
So you think it's justified, do you, this lack of...
Yes, life? Yeah. I think, you know, we've seen, I mean, something that I speak about a lot, but kind of the impact of politics and ideology on the NHS we've seen in terms of, there's over 10,000 roles within the NHS that are related to diversity, equity, inclusion. The NHS spends loads of money on this. It's also spending more and more money on kind of net zero policies, trying to make ambulances electric and so on. I mean, if you wanted to make the NHS truly net zero, you'd have to essentially rebuild the whole thing. I mean, hundreds of millions of pounds being spent on this. As someone working in the NHS, you know, I see how we get, you know, services get given a budget of a certain amount of money to spend, but they're told that, you know, after a certain amount of time, 6 months or a year, they won't have that money. So they spend it very quickly and unthinkingly on, usually on tech, but they don't invest it into, you know, staff and keeping, holding down staff. So there's a high turnover of staff in the NHS. Most staff report feeling undervalued. And as I said, it's increasingly politicised. And of course, it's experiencing the effects of mass immigration as well. You know, I think now, because I don't know if it'd be even fair to call it a national health service, it's more like an international health service. In that we have, you know, it spends hundreds of millions of pounds on health tourists, people that come to this country just to use the NHS and then go, and overseas visitors as well. So, and of course, the effect of that is that the burden is placed on the taxpayer, the people that have lived all their lives and put that money in. I think a lot of people now across the political spectrum are feeling a huge amount of resentment towards our NHS.
Although at the same time in this survey, it said 9 out of 10 people wish it were not the case. They are very pro NHS. They're pro the idea of the NHS, the institution.
Well, the idea of the NHS is perfectly sound, you know, and I still believe very strongly in this whole concept, the very essence being free at the point of service. And I think that's, you know, that's a laudable aim for any institution to have in the public health system. But this blind devotion, this sort of the religious zeal with which people are devoted to this. So, you know, I mean, the most absurd example being in the 2012 London Olympics, when you had a whole section devoted to the NHS, to the bewilderment of people around the world, because for some reason in this country, we've thought for decades that the whole world looks upon us with envy for our NHS, which simply isn't the case. It's no longer fit for purpose for all the reasons that Amy has said, not to mention the fact that we're training our brightest and best doctors who then go and leave to other countries in America and Canada and elsewhere where they can earn far more money. And instead of that, we're importing into this country doctors, depriving their home countries of doctors, but also importing here doctors who aren't trained to the same standards as our own doctors are. But then when you do get a GP, you never know each time you go whether you'll have the same GP again. All of these are the reasons people have dissatisfaction, because that sort of level of care has decreased hugely. Look, we need to have a root and branch reform of the NHS. And I think that includes possibly looking at the way that it's funded. Now, whenever you try to discuss funding of the NHS, people immediately think you're trying to turn us into an American-style system. The very best healthcare systems in the world, with a couple of exceptions, all have a proportion of private health insurance or national health insurance being incorporated there. Yeah. Singapore, Japan, Korea, Germany, Switzerland, Norway, Sweden, these are the world's most successful healthcare systems, producing the best outcomes. And as much as we're devoted to the ideology of the NHS being a publicly funded thing, I think outcomes must be far more important and relevant. We actually pay rather less than we should be paying. We pay about 20% less for healthcare than in other countries. So if you really do want to have a proper healthcare system that actually does have an ability to deal with things like cancer and so forth, we will have to pay for it, but not in the current model, because we know how much waste there is. We need to be willing to pay more, but we need to have a sensible discussion about having the actual private individual contribute to that directly. In Japan, they pay 30%, the nation pays 70%. In Singapore, you pay 10% of your salary every month goes into this. There are all sorts of options there that we should be able to openly discuss, and for some reason, no politician is willing to have those discussions.
Well, particularly the Tories, actually, because, I mean, they're always on the hook, aren't they? Oh, they, you know, they're basically wanting to privatise. It's absolute rubbish, actually. And look, I'm not standing up for the Tory party here, but, I mean, in terms of money, they have ploughed money in, as we know, to it. It is a kind of, as you say, a structural thing. I noticed, well, that Jeremy Hunt, in his speech, budget speech, said that this was our greatest treasure, didn't he? Well, I'm sorry, but I mean, you know, we're not just a country. It's like an NHS for the country attached, if we're not careful, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Tories, I think they've championed the NHS so much in an attempt to get away from the idea of them being the nasty party or the party of privatisation. They've put so much money into the NHS over the last 10 and 14 years. It's a complete myth that that there's been cuts to the NHS. While there may have been cuts to certain services, overall, the money going into the NHS has gone up and up and up. So much money is being put into it. And that money is not, the point is that the increasing the amount of money going into the NHS doesn't improve things, because it's how the money's being spent. It's often being spent on more management, more bureaucracy. As a nurse, you know, I'm on the front line. I often felt that I'm like a bureaucrat first and the nurse second. I have to do all of this form filling in and ticking all these boxes so I can actually just see a patient. And even then I'm sort of thinking about all the things I've got to do. So much money has been, you know, put into the wrong things in the NHS. It's the management of it that needs to change. It's the structure. It needs ploughing more and more money into it isn't going to help. And I think that's the real issue here.
I think it's the case in France, I think, and possibly Germany, you can tell me from what, that people pay a nominal amount when they even have an appointment. So, you know, for example, the number of people who don't turn up here is huge. I mean, so I remember sitting in my, you know, where the doctor's waiting room was, NHS, and there was a sign saying, you know, 200 appointments missed or whatever this month, this cost us such and such. And you sort of think, you know, what is so wrong about just a fiver or something like that, you know, just to go and see, you know, as a one-off charge when you're there? Because, and also maybe it will cut down on what you might call people who are frivolous about going.
Yeah, but I think people use and abuse the NHS as much as they like, because there's no, as you say, no repercussions for not turning up for an appointment. And I think people have a lot of resentment towards the NHS, so they just think, you know, I've seen it myself, lots of as you say, lots of patients don't turn up for appointments, and staff often bend over backwards to try to reach out to them. And there's no incentive to how much you use or don't use the NHS, or how much you treat or how you treat it. And as I said, you know, health tourism and people coming in who haven't even paid into the system are also doing that, also using it for their own gain.
I think when you said hundreds of millions in what we call health tourism, that might even be understating it. I seem to remember some figure of 2 billion or something.
That's for overseas visitors, so people that have been here not very long, and maybe they've been here a year or so, but they certainly haven't spent their adult life putting into the system. It's ridiculous.
This politicisation of it as well. I mean, there have been a few cases, have there not, recently? In fact, there was one that was in the paper this morning about some young kid, Jewish kid, who was basically just left, you know, and he wasn't given the kind of care he should have been. And also nurses wearing these Free Palestine badges and things. I mean, is that something you recognise in your experience, you know?
I can't say that I've experienced that sort of thing directly, but certainly you can just tell from the demographics within the NHS that those issues are going to arise, because, you know, people don't leave their politics at home, no matter how much they try, you know, to a degree that's going to be present. But yes, you know, other countries don't seem to have the same issue with tourism, the NHS tourism that we do. You know, countries like Singapore, etc., you will pay 100% of the costs if you don't have national health insurance, for example. You know, and so there are lots of ways that other countries are able to deal with this. I don't like charging people for doctor's appointments. I think people should be fined if they don't attend their doctor's appointment. I don't want people not to go for an appointment because of the financial aspect. But if they don't turn up, then I think their next appointment they should pay for, there should be a fine of some sort. But I just think the whole structure needs to be changed so that situation doesn't arrive, if people are actually obliged to have a portion of their income go towards the NHS where they can actually see it, or even just have a hypothecated tax where you can actually see. You know, I think we spend about 18% of our income tax goes to the NHS. If people can actually see that and clearly, you know, they realize the cost that this is, then I think there'll be people that will realize how important it is actually to show up for these things.
I would say it's an important point about, you know, other countries, because it's always said, is it, oh, do you want to be like America? Do you really want that? You know, where they won't even treat you unless you've got insurance. A lot of that is a myth, actually. In fact, the strange thing about America is it is harsh a private scheme until you get 65, and then it can be very good with Medicare, interestingly enough. So if you can hang on that long.
Well, and the important thing to know, most of the best countries around the world, which have obligatory national health insurance to cover essential things, everyone gets it irrespective of their age or of their health conditions. They all pay the same fee. So it's not as if if you are 70 years old and you've got some predisposition towards cancer, you'll pay more than an 18-year-old who's fit and healthy. And I think people have to understand. And also, we're not talking about huge sums of money either. So I think there are a lot of myths that exist around the idea of health insurance, which we need to actually be able to discuss and explode. Yeah.
As you say, though, I mean, I think it was Nigel Lawson who said that the NHS is the nearest Britain has to a national religion now. And it is sort of, it's part also, is it not, of the kind of culture in which we're living now, which is just absolutely, you know, it's to do with care, it's to do, isn't it, with illness. And it's somehow this is the most precious thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of entitlement in the way that people use the NHS and a lot of kind of safetyism, I think. We saw that in COVID. And it overlaps with the kind of woke agenda. I think the politicisation of the NHS is happening more and more often. We're seeing people wearing lanyards with, Black Lives Matter and LGBT. And there is a kind of overlap, as you say, with the kind of ethos of victimhood. Championing people that are, have problems and elevating their problems and making it the most important thing about them and making it all about our needs and our health and self-care and so on. I think there is something going on.
I think the one way of illustrating this politicization is that if somebody did come in and say, right, we're going to seriously try and reduce health tourism, for example, or bring a law in or something like that, you can almost be sure that the people in the NHS themselves would not administer it. They would just say, no, we're not doing that. We are absolutely not. They would simply not administer the law.
I mean, there's a lot of similarity between the takeover of our medical system, as we've seen in education, where there's been a huge swing to the left amongst teachers. The same thing has happened in the nursing profession. To a lesser degree amongst doctors, but still overwhelmingly left-wing too. And of course, they all subscribe to the notion of open borders to some degree or another, and part of that includes being able to treat people wherever they come from.
Yeah, and speaking of open borders, which we very rarely do on this show, very interesting, some statistics, some data issues this week, Rafe. Well, they seem unrelated, but the thing that seems to me to connect them is that now that people are being a little more open about talking about migration, they're trying to find out things, the state of play when it comes to data is actually coming up now into the daylight, isn't it? I mean, can you explain what it is, particularly Neil O'Brien's?
That's right. So Neil O'Brien, a Tory MP, former minister, has written a piece essentially showing how information about the nationality of people is being deleted from the Office of National Statistics and so forth. So you can't find out now what nationalities are paying the most or the least tax. You can't find out which nationalities living in this country can receive the most benefits or the fewest benefits, or indeed when it comes to sort of convictions or crimes, which nationalities commit the most and the least crimes. And this information is being denied to the British people. And you would think, surely, the more information, the better. You know, if you want to decide which countries are the best to encourage migration from or reduce migration from, if you're dealing with things like health tourism, for example, things like that, one of the reasons we were able to introduce the National Health Service charge on foreigners coming over here is precisely because we could see before which nationalities were actually using the NHS, and so you were able to determine all of these things. This comes at the same time as Nigel Farage and GB News have begun a campaign about trying to identify the nationality of sex crime attacks in this country, particularly in relation to those who are asylum seekers in this country, because that information is held by the Ministry of Justice, but they've refused the Freedom of Information request to publish all of this. Meanwhile, in Denmark, they do have this information, and it's very telling to see. It's precisely as one would expect in terms of being a drain on the economy. Migrants coming from North Africa and the Middle East, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, Pakistan are the biggest drains on the economy, whereas immigration from Western Europe, America and India are the biggest contributors to the Dutch economy. Now, those are important things to know, and yet we are being denied that sort of information here. We do know the nationality of prisoners, but we don't know the nationality of what crimes they've committed. All that we have in this country to help us determine these things is ethnicity. But it's such a broad they describe Asians, for example. Now, that includes everyone from someone from Japan to someone from Pakistan, two completely different types of migrant that are coming to this country. But what we do know is that, for example, whilst immigrants ethnic minorities make up 13% of the population, they account for 27% of the convictions for crimes in this country. Now, but that needs further analysis to break down precisely what's happening, and we're being denied that.
Yes, I mean, we're actually at the NCF going to be doing some serious research on this, actually, and we'll produce a publication about it. Because as you say, you mentioned in Holland, that was strictly about economics, was it?
Denmark, yeah.
Right, okay. But what you were mentioning there with the crime statistics that I saw that Nigel actually tweeted out, that's Denmark, isn't it? And then basically it's quite extraordinary, or rather maybe not, depending on your view, but you've got this huge number at the top. And for some reason, Kuwaitis
Lots of refugees from Kuwait going to Denmark. And what's interesting is that they've also done graphs to show as a proportion of the population or relative to the native population, which groups commit most crimes, and if violent crimes. And if you look at Danes and Western immigrants, they have approximately the same level of homicides, violent crime, and rape. But when it comes to non-Western immigrants in Denmark, the violent crime and homicide rate is three times higher than it is for the native population. And when you get to rape, it's more than seven times higher amongst non-Western immigrants to Denmark. And of course, you know, there's no reason to assume that you wouldn't find similar statistics for other Western European nations, or indeed the situation here in this country. All that we really do know is that in this country, black people make up 4% of the population, but they're 9% of the prison population. Asians make up 9% of the population, but they are about 8 or 7% of the prison population. Whites are 83% of the population, but only 79% of the prison population. But even there, we're just told about whites. We don't have white British as a standalone group. Yeah. That will include Albanians, that will include Romanians, and so forth.
Yes, it's a little bit like these statistics that came out quite recently about Bristol, I think. And it was the rate of rape and violent attack had just rocketed in the past few years. I mean, just gone up a treble by 300%. And so one wants to find out why this is, whilst at the same time looking at it, and some things seem, you know, to be quite clear. I mean, you know, this is a period of time of mass migration.
Yeah, the same is true for London as well, that sexual assault and sexual crimes have gone up in London. And obviously that's in the era of mass immigration, which London has experienced heavily. And generally, you know, Sadiq Khan and generally the kind of establishment position on this is just it's toxic masculinity, or it's men, but they don't want to break down which sort of men. I think there's similar statistics for Sweden as well, where if you break down crimes, actually Swedish people are very, very low, and actually it's a lot of the people that they've come into the country that are recently that are committing crimes. I think it's really interesting because we're living in an era that's obsessed with race and nationality and identity as a whole. We see so often where headlines about certain crimes, where the race will be in the headline, and yet in other crimes it's not. And we have this almost complete contradiction in our society at the moment, where we're saying race and nationality and identity is everything, and then at the same time we're burying it. We don't want to look at it. Well, either it's important or it's not. We have to decide. And if it's important, then there should be no area in which statistics are not looked at or nationality isn't considered.
Well, it's important insofar as it helps the narrative of you know, what is positive. I mean, with these, with Neil O'Brien's piece about revenue, tax revenue, and for that matter, benefits, I mean, the obvious seems to me is that they're covering something up. I mean, you know, if you decide not to print this anymore, not to keep it anymore, so that you can avoid, you know, freedom of information requests, why would you do that? Why would you suddenly do that? Is it because actually, you know, facts go against what you want to argue?
That's exactly right. All of this explodes the myth that diversity is our greatest strength. It's impossible to stand on a platform and argue that when you have the statistics clearly showing the opposite to be the case. And in terms of Neil O'Brien, when he did request this information, you know, being an MP, he had to get a formal reply. And they said that the reason that we're not publishing nationality data is that the reasons for first compiling this are no longer relevant. Well, that's another way of saying, actually, this is causing more harm than good to this image of, you know, and the idea of social cohesion that we're creating. And I think it's something which is only going to make people feel more untrusting of institutions. Mm-hmm. They're going to know something is afoot rather than being able to come clean, so we can actually deal with this very growing issue. Mm. And it's only going to grow greater as we see far larger numbers of people coming to this country. I mean, for example, you know, Muslims are 7% of the population of this country. They are 18% of the prison population. Hindus, who are about 2% of the population, are less than 1% of the prison population. Now, those are the sorts of things you need to be able to discuss when you are looking at immigration and all these sorts of issues.
All this is going to also become more relevant because there was a piece by one Stephen Davis, who's an historian, in the Telegraph. He was actually commenting on a report in The Lancet, which was reported on a bit, but from a different angle. But the thrust of what he's saying is that there is the most catastrophic decline in the birth rate worldwide, right? But also this is leading to populational movement, you know, obviously, which we've covered on this show before, because there was a great book actually called Youthquake, which was done by Ed Pace, and he was sort of concentrating on sub-Saharan Africa. But, I mean, this particular piece by Stephen Davis is always saying that, well, for example, Europe's had it, forget it.
Yeah, well, Europe is the oldest continent, and they say it may lose half of its population by the end of the century. Average age in Europe is about 43 years of age. Mm-hmm. Japan's the worst at 49 years of age. And the doomsayers here say, oh, well, this is going to be a huge calamity for Europe and for the world, because you're going to basically have no economic growth. You're going to have a stagnant society. There'll be no young people to innovate and develop our civilization and so forth. But I think actually a lot of this is overly pessimistic, because, you know, a population decline of 2 or 3 million will just take us back to where we were when I was young, actually, or even when I was in my teenage years. Innovation, all right. So if we don't get that much innovation, life was fine in the 1990s. You know, the last 30 years we have a lot of innovation, but there's no reason that we need to increase innovation exponentially as we have. You know, the last 300 years since the Industrial Revolution have been an abnormal period in world civilization. Mm. Before that, we grew at a much slower pace. If we need to dial down all of that, I don't see what the problem with that is. A lower population will also mean house prices will be cheaper, for example. Do you know? there are all sorts of relevant issues here. Also, I think very importantly, this is happening at the same time as we're having the AI and robotics revolution, a revolution just as important as the internet or the Industrial Revolution. So all those sorts of issues that people are talking about, are there won't be enough people in the NHS to staff things? Well, actually, AI and because we're talking about 70 years to 100 years from now. Mm. So whilst now, of course, we can't imagine that, in 50 or 70 years, we'll be living in an entirely different universe when it comes to these sorts of things. So many jobs won't exist any longer because of AI and technology. So I think a lot of the doomsayers actually might need to reevaluate all of this in that context.
I think one of the reasons why they're being, you know, doom-laden about it, particularly with Europe, is that essentially it will mean almost certainly huge movement of young men from sub-Saharan Africa into Europe, which is we're sort of already seeing in a way, but I mean it would end on a vast scale. In other words, that We might, all those things might be true, but at the same time, the culture of the country will simply not be the same. I mean, it will be a different continent. It will have the same building standing, but entirely different people in it.
I mean, I think that's the most worrying thing. I think it, and also that politicians will use this issue as a reason to justify immigration. Mm. That obviously we've been told for decades now that mass immigration is bringing, you know, will improve the economy. That's now been disproven. So you may well see a political class that shift towards saying, well, actually, we need more people in the country because of our birth rates. I think what was potentially positive about this study, if you could give it a positive spin, was that this did show that it's a global thing. I think we in the West often feel that it's us.
You know, I did.
Yeah, I do. That we think, you know, everywhere else, China and India and other Africa are having loads of babies and it's just a Western thing. And we usually cite our individualism or our liberalism as being reasons for that. Whereas actually this is a global thing. So it kind of shows you that actually it's not just a Western thing. So I thought that was quite interesting. I think most of us sort of on a day-to-day basis feel kind of our general concern is that there's too many people. There's about 10 million people living in London now, and generally we feel like resources are scarce. So it's quite hard to take in a study that's kind of raising the alarm about there not being enough people. But it does seem to be the direction it will be going in. I think this study showed that by the end of the century, it will only be some countries in Africa where the birth rate's higher than the death rates. But actually, even in the Middle East, and various places, the birth rate will be going down. So it will change things geopolitically and culturally in a huge way, not just for the West.
Yes.
But that's my point. There's no need for us to be worried about a declining population. Immigration's another issue entirely from North Africa and elsewhere, but that's up to governments to stop that. But, you know, if the will is there to stop people coming into this country, we shouldn't be afraid of a decline in population, because it actually may lead to an improvement in our lives. You know, fewer NHS waiting lists, more places in schools, as I said, lower house prices. You know, and again, the rise of technology dealing with all the sort of issues that are problems now. No the taxes we pay to pay public servants dramatically decline. So there's a lot of reason to be optimistic about the future, as long as we're able to actually stem the migration flows.
Yes. Well, that's the big if, isn't it? I mean, I think I agree. In a sense, a report like this it's huge. It's worth looking up, by the way. Telegraph, it was in, Stephen Davis. At the same time, it gives this long perspective, doesn't it? So as you say, 300 years has been unusual. So before that, things were much sort of slower. Why would you say, though, you know, because when it comes to the West, I sort of have all my pat answers as to why, you know, why. Oh, well, it's because women don't want to have so many children. There's a general sense of malaise, which I think can affect that, and the expense of it. But I generally think it's when basically people feel there's no real future. Even on a subconscious level, they just stop doing things which are about the future, having children. But it's a worldwide thing.
Well, it's because of capitalism. So the whole purpose of having large families, and that applied here in the 19th century and it applied in the 20th century in Africa and elsewhere, was because of the high infant mortality rate and the need to have, and the lack of a social welfare system. So the dependence upon your children to look after you in your older age. As income levels in India and China and elsewhere have increased, and society has improved, there's no longer the need to have all of that. And instead of basically spending money across 10 children, people are more willing to spend that money on one or two children and give them a much better quality of life and much better chances in life. And also, of course, tied in with that, women around the world are becoming more sort of liberated, if I can use that term, going into the workforce and all the rest of it. So with all the problems that entails. Mm. And also there's a general decrease in male fertility, which is another big
problem. No one apparently can still explain this. Mm. You know, that it's dropped hugely since, well, I think the Second World War.
I think it's 1% per year since the 1970s, yeah, dropping well fertility.
What's going on there? I mean, I remember P.D. James wrote a great book in the 90s. She was known as a detective writer, but she wrote something called Children of Men, which was then made into a very good film, actually. But she sort of, it was very prescient, 1990, no one's having kids anymore, and there's this one person who becomes pregnant. I wonder why it should happen. You say capitalism. Mm.
I wonder also...
No, but it is it's an accepted fact, people having fewer children, because children were there to support the parents. That was the whole purpose.
The reason for immigration often here is because Europe has the biggest public spending, or should we say social spending, of anywhere in the world. So naturally, they come here. You know, it's not for our values. You know, it's for this. But of course, when that collapses, as maybe it will do, because there's no money anymore, maybe those huge movements will stop.
Not necessarily, because we still have better infrastructure and more job opportunities as well. So there may be some of that, but I think just the quality of life in Europe is far better than in Africa and so forth, where it's primitive stuff in a lot of places.
We'll never know that, because they're now hiding the stats.
They're hiding the stats. But another issue in the West is the fact that people now have far more isolated existences. Mm. So in Japan, for example, young men, I think that there's a huge number of men under 40 who are still virgins. And they have cyber girlfriends now, these sort of bots, the avatars that exist now. Now that's coming over to Europe, because in Europe now, youngsters are having less sex than at any point in history. Mm. It's good on the one side, there are far fewer teenage pregnancies, but at the same time, that's one of the reasons you're having fewer children as well. So there's a whole bunch of things going on at the same time, I think.
Yes.
It may also be because we're living in a digital age now, where most people in most countries, you know, can access and look at different lifestyles around the globe. Mm. So there's going to be more reasons to not have children or to have other ambitions, whereas ordinarily you'd just have your community and you would look to your family as to how you live your life. Whereas now there's so many kind of infinite opportunities or ways of living that people are deciding not to have children. Yes. And of course, the availability of contraception as well.
But you see, it's amazing, is it? People still sort of hanker after, you know, the big family. It's just they now do it by looking at films and things. You know, I remember, you know, you remember Eat, Pray, Love? It was that Julia Roberts film. I remember that very much. It's very typical of a couple, you know, leading this very, you know, ascetic life, very, very wealthy and everything. But, you know, they gloried in being amongst people and amongst the families that they went out to see when they travelled around the world. So people still want that in a way, don't they? I mean, because just while we're finishing off, loneliness, you know, in the West, for the reasons that you said about the atomization, you know, is now an epidemic proportion, essentially. That in fact, you know, there was again a piece in the Times, and the guy was absolutely correct. You know, he was saying, rather than look inside yourself all the time, sorry, I know you're a therapeutic nurse, but you know, I read your wonderful work. But apart from that, instead of doing that, actually go out and be with people. So, you know, with this mental health crisis we've got at the moment, you know, that's the very place they should be, is going to work, you know, not sitting at home.
Well, it may well be with this population crisis. I mean, we're going to have an increasing sort of retirement age pensioner demographic and less people in the workplace. So it may well be an incentive to have a kind of an extended family. We may well be forced into looking after our elders more because that's just the way the things land. I mean, I don't know. But yeah, I think with affluence comes more introspection. And I think that that's become a kind of sickness in itself.
I don't think it's sort of actually hits us quite yet, because people of I say our age, I'm far older than you, but I mean basically people in 30s, 40s, whatever, they are facing life probably in a residential home. I mean, en masse, in a way that we've never seen before. You know, so you've got that to anyway, so haven't we? Thank you very much, Amy Riff. We ended on a sort of cautiously optimistic note there about the world, which seems appropriate because it's Easter. I do hope you're having a nice weekend, weren't you? And we enjoy the rest of it. Happy Easter to you. And we shall see you next week. Thank you.
Hello. If you're enjoying the New Culture Forum channel and you believe in our mission, may I invite you to join our membership scheme at the link below or on our website, newcultureforum.org.uk. Our work is more important now than ever, and we have great plans ahead for the future, but we can't do it without your support. From as little as £3 per month, you can help ensure that we continue on our mission. As a member, you'll receive a range of benefits, including access to exclusive content, invitations to our private events, including here at our studios, free copies of our books, and much, much more, including, of course, our famous NCF mug. If you aren't able to become a member, then please help us by clicking this button and subscribing to our channel. It's completely free. Just remember to also click the bell icon so that you can get notifications when we post new videos. Thank you.